Welcome to the latest daily bulletin from Red Star Radio, covering all the major events today from the Ukraine war, its associated political and economic effects, and also fielding a question from yesterday's rather long presentation that I did on the nature of fascism. So I'll be dealing with the military affairs first, then looking at some political events before moving to the question in the latter part of the program. First of all, I will begin with a run-through of the various reported major events that have taken place on the front line in eastern Ukraine and southwest Russia over the last 24 hours. Now, there has been significant action around the Ugledar area, where the Russian armed forces have begun an assault over the night of the 28th to the 29th of October. So that's the previous evening to when I'm recording this. And this was a significant assault that had some success in pushing the Ukrainian armed forces back from that particular area. This was reported as taking the form of a widespread series of air attacks and artillery barrages, followed by the Russian infantry moving up and taking over positions formerly occupied by the Ukrainians. There's also movement up to near Krasny Liman, the place which was the loss of which caused so much hue and cry in the Russian military blogosphere and online world, and caused a lot of criticism to come even from inside Russia towards some of the Russian military commanders. The Russians are moving back to a point where they could be retaking the town very soon. So around Ugledar and up towards Krasny Liman, the Russians are actually on the advance now, either taking back ground they previously gave up or conquering new territory. And this comes as, of course, the Russian numbers on the front lines are bolstered by at least 80,000 of the mobilized men who have already completed their training or retraining and have made their way to the front lines. There are also some small movements in the favor of the Russian armed forces in Marinka and Avdiivka. And of course, there is the continued battle inside what and around what the city the Ukrainians refer to as Bakhmut and the Russians refer to as Artemovsk. And it's there that the armed forces of Russia are led by the Wagner Group, private military organization, are continuing their slow advance through the industrial zone near a bunch of fortifications in an area known as Opitnoy. And this is, again, part of the very slow advance, which I report every single day. But it seems that the determined advance through there continues, regardless of anything the Ukrainians try in terms of potential counteroffensive. Now, the Ukrainians have staged some counteroffensives themselves over the last 24 hours in the area of Svatovo. Apparently, they increased their attempts to break through there using heavy artillery fire to try and break the Russian lines. They also seized a village by the name of Nevsko, and they continue to make, according to Russian reports on this, serious attacks in the area with an intention of advancing. So again, the Ukrainians are on the move at one point of the front line. Russians on the move in more areas. But generally, though, the front line hasn't changed too dramatically in the last 24 hours. It's generally been quite stable for a while now. And of course, the big area that's been the most talked about over the past couple of weeks is Kherson, where the Ukrainians continue to try and do probing attacks in the Nikopol and Kryvyi Rog area, but they have been unable to obtain any significant breakthrough so far. And each time they move down there, they apparently suffer significant casualties. So there is some movement on the front line. There is also indications that the Russians continue to build serious defenses. There's been footage taken of huge trucks carrying gigantic concrete blocks that are going to be used as tank obstacles down to the front line area. The Russians are very much digging in around a lot of the front line to ensure that when they do come to advance in a few weeks' time, that they'll be doing so with a solid set of defenses behind them. Because obviously that makes any potential advance obviously more secure, because they're advancing with a firm defensive line to fall back to in the case of any Ukrainian comeback. So interesting things to note there. There continues to be documented reports of large amounts of military equipment going into Belarus, but the numbers that are being talked about so far indicate it's mainly defensive in its measures. In terms of the numbers, there's not enough there, apparently, according to the Russian sources, to indicate that an imminent attack is coming from the northern sector. The Ukrainians, though, are taking it seriously, and the Ukrainian government sources have confirmed that they are building up their own defences in the northern part of the country, which, if nothing else, has forced the Ukrainians to divert resources to guarding the northern flank, which could have been sent elsewhere, for instance, Bakhmut or Kherson or Ugledar. So significant there in the case of a build-up that is forcing the Ukrainians to divert what are already rather stretched resources. There is also, of course, the continued rumours about the Ukrainians running out of men, about various Ukrainian units refusing to advance, about the Ukrainians having to start using the Banderas battalions, who have been used as brutal political officers and disciplinary units, and actually throw them into the front line. All of those are rumours so far, no documented cases of it that have been confirmed, but there is a likelihood that some of these things are happening. It's just that there's no clear evidence other than talk on Russian social media channels, which doesn't really count as anything other than just talk. So there are things to keep an eye on. The Russians continue to pour their forces into all different sections of the front line to make sure it's thoroughly reinforced. And only when they've, of course, finished doing that process and the mobilized men are all transferred to their units will they be ready to actually move to their next step in their likely offensives. So as things stand at the moment, the major event of the last 24 hours didn't actually take place on the front lines as such, but it did indeed take place as part of the theater of this war, which is, of course, the Ukrainian attempt to carry out a raid in Sevastopol Harbor, which is where the Russian Black Sea Fleet is based, and also part of the fleet that the Russians have been using as part of this grain export deal from Ukraine. Now, what the Russians have said, and this appears to be the truth, is that the Ukrainians staged an attack on the Black Sea Fleet using sea drones, so remote-controlled military vehicles, basically remote-controlled boats that can fire missiles, torpedoes, etc. So there was several sea-based drones supported by unmanned aerial vehicles that are also equipped with missiles, and this was all monitored in neutral territory by an American surveillance drone that was watching the whole thing. The Russians are saying that other than damage to one minesweeper, the missiles and torpedoes fired were all intercepted and the drones all destroyed and the remnants of them captured. Now, you might say, well, it's a war, what's the big deal? These kind of things is likely to happen given the large amount of military equipment that the Americans and the British and others are pouring into Ukraine, including advanced sea drone weaponry, and they're bound to try and have a go at the Black Sea Fleet after the successful sinking of the Moskva cruiser a few months ago, which, again, by all accounts that are reliable, there was an American and British role in this somewhere. And this was not really denied whenever it's been put to any British official. And it's clear that they had some role in it, even if the Ukrainians were the ones pulling the trigger. Now, what the Russians are saying about this attack in Sevastopol is that this was carried out using sea lane space that was supposed to be dedicated to the grain shipments that are leaving Ukraine as part of this grain deal that was brokered by Erdogan and the UN to enable the export of Ukrainian grain out of the port of Odessa. Now, this was heavily criticized inside Russia itself when the Russian government agreed to this, and Putin himself has made several comments about this, about how over 80% of the grain that is shipped from Ukraine has ended up in Western European markets. And that makes, of course, complete sense, because the Western Europeans will be desperate to get hold of as much cheap grain as possible for the to help out their own food production, or buy it up to secure supply. And so this completely cynical maneuver is to be entirely expected from these people. And so the Russian Ministry of Defense and Russian Foreign Ministry have said is that not only was this attack constructed by British experts, and they directly accused the British government of being involved in the planning of this, even if it was the Ukrainians executing it, but because it took place in the sea lanes that are meant to be dedicated to the ships covering the grain deal, this means basically that the grain deal is off. Now, I'll read the statement that was put out by the Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs. It's quite short, so I can read the whole thing to you. It says as follows. On the 29th of October, the Ukrainian armed forces, under the cover of the humanitarian corridor set up for the implementation of the Black Sea Grain Initiative for the export of Ukrainian agricultural products, launched massive air and sea strikes using drones against Russian Black Sea Fleet ships and infrastructure at the naval base in Sevastopol. As a result of these actions, which cannot be qualified as anything other than a terrorist attack by the Ukrainian armed forces led by British specialists, directed in particular against Russian ships ensuring the functioning of the humanitarian corridor, the Russian side can no longer guarantee the safety of civilian dry cargo ships participating in the Black Sea Grain Initiative and will suspend its implementation from today for an indefinite period. Corresponding instructions have been issued to Russian representatives at the Joint Coordination Center in Istanbul, which is in charge of the transportation of Ukrainian food products. End quote. This statement has also been repeated by the Russian ambassador to the United Nations, Vasily Nebenzia, and the Russian government say they are going to raise it at a meeting of the United Nations. They have also clearly accused the British government of being directly involved at the level of planning in the attack on the Nord Stream pipelines. And again, were the British directly involved in this, or did they have a hand in it and it was carried out by somebody else, maybe the Poles? Judging from the kind of people who make up the British government at the senior levels, my guess is that both in terms of the attack on Sevastopol and this alleged involvement in the Nord Stream 2 and Nord Stream 1 pipelines and the attempt to put them out of commission, I would say that the British government's role was in the planning and the equipment provision side of it, and that they found willing co-conspirators to carry out the dirty work in order to retain some plausible deniability. I would say that in terms of the Sevastopol incident, certainly the British will have been involved in the provision of intelligence, the training of the Ukrainian operators to use these sea and air drones, the construction of how the attack was supposed to go, everything other than the actual controlling of the drones and the pulling of the triggers. That's the level of involvement the British government will probably have had. And if it's true that they were involved in the Nord Stream pipeline attack, the same thing will be true there. They will want to retain, them and the Americans, the appearance of non-involvement, however implausible and ridiculous it seems. They all want to make the argument, well, we're just helping Ukraine. We're not a direct party to the conflict because we don't have officially the British government employees pulling the trigger on something. It will be the same as their defense when it comes to the Yemen war, to be honest. We're not directly involved, but we are running and have been running for years the targeting center for the Saudi Air Force. Of course, whether they still keep doing that is another question. That's going to be interesting to see how that particularly repulsive relationship develops from this point onwards, given MBS's apparent determination to pursue a different line when it comes to foreign affairs now. But that's another matter for another day. At this stage, though, it's important to realize that, of course, the British and the role that the British government plays in relation to US imperialism often take on the role of being the most aggressive advocate for the most over-the-top actions that US imperialism has taken. The British always used to portray themselves as being the moderating influence. In actual fact, in recent years, as British power has diminished, and as has American power, but of course British power is much more diminished, they often advocate for the most extreme action. In fact, If we recall back to the Libyan war, it was David Cameron and Nicolas Sarkozy who were actually far more militant in their desire to go after Gaddafi than even Obama was. Of course, Hillary Clinton was right in the mix there, arguing for that position in the American government, but she was backed up in her position by the British and the French. And in the case of Ukraine, there seems to be, of course, some sort of division within the British government between some of the senior level politicians, like the new Prime Minister Sunak, who gives all the lip service about support Ukraine, that kind of thing, but isn't too happy, it would seem, about endless defence spending commitments. And of course, the functionaries in the Ministry of Defence and the Intelligence Services, who I've talked about before, many of whom are running wild out there and chomping at the bit for ever greater offensive actions against Russia, as are like the complete psychopaths in the Houses of Parliament, like Tobias Elwood, a man who will scream all day for a war as long as it still remains the Ukrainians largely doing the fighting. And that's the continued attitude that the British government is going to take. It's interesting that the Russians have come out and said that the British were involved directly. I mean, I've no reason to doubt that they would be involved directly, and that they're the ones taking the role, taking the lead role here, rather than it being the United States. I'm sure the United States is involved, but the British are just the ones fronting up the operation. So the grain deal is suspended. This was probably a foreseen byproduct of this from the point of view of the British. No skin off their nose. They get to portray Putin, the evil one, denying the third world food, even though, of course, the developing world, sub-Saharan Africa, places like that, aren't getting their hands on the overwhelming majority of the grain exported from Ukraine. It's going into the Western countries' grain warehouses. And, of course, the Russian government has offered to supply 500,000 tons of their own grain free of charge to developing nations, and also other wheat and grain exports at a lower than market rate, or a just slightly above market rate. There's been various statements made on that throughout the course of the day by Patrushev from the Russian Ministry of Agriculture. So they're saying that they're happy to make up the difference. Of course, this will be an offer that is not taken up on by the West, who will be desperate to block Russian grain going anywhere and will be desperate to inflict punishment on any government from any part of the world, but particularly the African nations, who tries to take them up on this deal. And threats will be made, etc. Anything to be able to portray Russia as the villain of the peace. But clearly, the opportunity provided by the shipping lanes that are meant to be used for the exporting of grain was just too tempting a target for the Ukrainians and their British handlers. And so we get the spectacle of the attack on Sevastopol, and the Russians labelling it a terrorist attack. Now, that's a rather curious choice of words, you might think, given that this was a Ukrainian attack on Russian ships in the middle of a war, kind of thing you would expect. But I mean, the Russians are labelling it terrorism. Partly there's propaganda in there, but I think mostly it's because the attack came using those what are supposed to be humanitarian shipping lanes, and that's why they're labeling it a terrorist attack. It's also curious, and this is more of a reflection of my own gathering of knowledge here, a lot of Russians, from people on the radical end of the Russian nationalist right to Russian communists, regard the British imperialists with far greater loathing and contempt than they do the Americans. I suppose at least with the Americans, they still have to respect a certain amount of American military strength, given the American nuclear stockpile and their submarine fleet. But I suppose the British have all the vileness of an imperial overlord, all the arrogance, but none of the power anymore. They just hide behind the Americans. And also, there seems to be a belief that the British have more power than we actually do. Our ruling class is much diminished, guys. They are perpetually hiding behind the skirts of Uncle Sam, and they can't do anything on their own anymore. They're only able to operate this way in Ukraine under the umbrella of the American military. Once that goes, they're fucked. So I think the Russians slightly overestimate the power of the British. The British only have power really now in two ways. One way is, as the book by Tony Norfield chronicles, the role that the City of London has played in the global imperialist system run largely by the United States, and that Britain exists as an adjunct of that, an important adjunct of that. But with the diminishing power of the United States, and therefore there is a diminishing power of the City of London as well. It's becoming less and less of a key financial centre. It's still very important, but when more and more countries start realising that they can just create the financial services that the City of London used to provide almost exclusively, like shipping insurance, then they're going to lose whatever power is left there. So the reason why the British reactionaries are so desperate over this war is that they have an awareness on some level that if this thing goes down in flames, then a further diminishing of American power means a diminishing of their power as well. And also they are clinging ever tighter to the United States following Brexit, and therefore are giving themselves even less of an option at reorientating themselves to maybe provide financial services to the Chinese or the Russians, given that they've just comprehensively alienated both countries. The options for the British ruling class bailing out on the Americans now have almost completely disappeared. So they've really cut off their own legs in a futile attempt to preserve the old imperial system that existed prior to this year, and certainly prior to the financial crisis of 2008. And as I've said before, this was the role that the British had in mind for themselves in perpetuity, this role of the global financial center, that was the service that they were going to provide in this global American empire. And when that all started going down in flames, they had no idea what to do, because, of course, that's been their sole gamble for the last 40 years, ever since they started the rapid process of deindustrialization, or the end of that process of deindustrialization. Really, the City of London's been all they've got going for them. The rest of British industry is minimal in terms of its actual contribution to GDP. So with the American hegemon going down now, slowly, but it is going down, the British will follow right along behind it. So the British Empire is now pretty much reduced to a rump like the final days of the Byzantine Empire. It basically consists now of the City of London, but maybe with a string of small military outposts across the world that they try and use for influencing operations, training operations. But the end is nigh now. The British bourgeoisie had a very long run, but it really is coming to a close, and it's coming to a close in contemptible and pathetic circumstances, so entirely appropriate that it does. So that's the big story coming out of the Ukraine-Russia war, or more accurately, the Russia-NATO war of the last 24 hours. There will be another round of attempts to portray Vladimir Putin as Vlad the Great Starver of the world, but of course, this was something which, again, needn't have happened. The Ukrainians didn't need to use this shipping lane to carry out their attacks. It was just the most convenient way of doing so. And that'll be the big devious plan of the British intelligence men who came up with this idea. But they did do it, and now the grain deal is off, and it's probably not going to come back on again, and not unless some serious concession to the Russians is made, which I doubt there will be one made. And therefore, the price of grain on the international market will doubtless go up again, provoking further food crises in the most vulnerable parts of the world. It's worth remembering that prior to the recession, the global recession of 2008 to 2010, that there were food riots over sudden dramatic rises in prices in places like Haiti, where, of course, there are renewed riots and uprisings now, as I covered in the interview recently with Dan Cohen. So watch the world food prices situation now this grain deal is off, and see if there's a knock-on impact there. Now, the continued smoke and mirrors over the sanctions regime imposed by the US and the EU nations continues. The talk of putting a cap on Russian gas, putting a price cap on Russian oil, weaning themselves off Russian energy exports, all this guff that Ursula von der Leyen spews forth every single day, every time she opens her mouth, again is revealed to be a giant stack of bullshit. And this is a story from the High North News website on their business section. And it reveals that Whilst EU imports of Russian pipeline gas have declined by 80%, shipments of Russian liquefied natural gas have actually increased by 50% during the first 9 months of 2022. That's this year, of course. And they've actually increased their purchase of Russian LNG this year. And the actual imports of Russian LNG totaled 15 billion cubic meters by September of this year. And this, of course, comes as they were talking about cutting off the supplies through Nord Stream 1 and then, of course, completely cut them off by blowing it up last month. And so the farce continues. And they're going to need more of this as time goes on, more of the liquefied natural gas and, of course, more of the farce. Because this is now at the stage of a deadly farce. Because at the moment, the Europeans and their American master are still in the process of furious denial. They're pretending that the sanctions are working. They're pretending that they're cutting themselves off from Russian oil and gas, even though they're not. LNG imports are going up, as we've just heard. Also, Russian oil just gets sold to India at a cheaper rate. The Indians then repackage it as something else, Indian oil or oil from somewhere else, and sell it on at a higher rate, making a lot of money in the process, and of course furthering the Russia-Indian alliance. And the pretense must continue, the pretense that the sanctions are working, the pretense that Ukraine can win a victory on the battlefield, the pretense that the Europeans and the Americans and the British aren't the ones running the Ukrainian government, the pretense that Ukraine has any sovereignty, the pretense that Zelensky is an actual president, the pretense that the Ukrainian army makes its own decisions when it manifestly does not, the pretense that they are making these decisions based on military need and not the need for PR victories to parade in front of the stuffed dummies of the various parliaments of Europe and the Congress of the United States. All just pretending. And it is like they are trying to pander to a senile elderly relative who wants to still be told that they can, that they've still got it. Which means that Joe Biden is the exact right president for this moment in time. He's the man who everybody has to pretend for. It's not just the fact that the emperor has no clothes anymore, it's that the emperor is obviously on his last legs, but needs to be told that with a good injection of stem cells or, you know, the blood of some virgins, maybe he can still get it up, so to speak. So the pretense will continue. And they, as, because this has an actual material root, of course, and the material root of all of this is the fact that US capitalism itself is on the slide due to the fact that, of course, that it has been overly financialized and is resting on these huge bubbles of debt, both corporate, private, and, of course, governmental debt as well. And US capitalism, frankly, domestically, doesn't make enough profit anymore, and the power of US imperialism is progressively diminishing. And nobody wants to admit to that in the corridors of power in Europe or in the United States right now. What we've got right now is just the big dim flickerings of some awareness that things are not going well. For instance, Scholz and Macron are now desperately trying to cook something up between themselves, but it's too late. The time for the French and the Germans to try and make a serious go of building their alliance into something more was 20 years ago, maybe longer, maybe 30 years ago. But of course, they just wanted to pretend that things could go on as they were, and that eventually the glaring contradictions in their position would resolve themselves somehow, that their attempt to buy huge amounts of Russian energy on the one hand, but also stiff the Russians over Ukraine on the other, wouldn't come back to bite them. But it did, that their allowing of their economies to atrophy, which is, of course, is what has been happening in Europe for many years now, which is, of course, part of the inevitable process of the advanced capitalist nations seeing the most productive parts of their economies wither away due to the natural tendency of the rate of profit to fall, but also the tendency that capitalism has, as I've mentioned a lot recently, towards just financializing itself, the cost of labor being too high in these countries for capital to make enough profit, All of these contribute towards industrial decline, heavy financialization, and of course more aggressive imperialism due to the need to seek out greater profit centers overseas. And of course, none of these things were ever properly tackled. The diminishing of the manufacturing base of France has been going on for years. There's been a diminishing of the German manufacturing base as well, but not to the same degree, not to the same great degree. But if you read or listen to Germans who are actually informed about the real state of German capitalism, you can see what's actually going on. Again, go back and listen to the interview that I did with Michael earlier this year, when the or late last year, actually, when the Scholz government had just come in. Or listen to the interviews given by the German sociologist Wolfgang Streeck, who's very clear that there's been a long-term decline there that's been masked by Angela Merkel's emphasis on greater car exports and greater usage of migrant labor in hyper-exploitative labor practices at home. But the decline's been there for a long time. In fact, the decline of German capitalism, really, you could date it back to reunification itself. Yes, there was growth in the 1990s, but it was, of course, nothing like the growth in West German capitalism. And the absorption and destruction of the East, whilst it was a high point for German capitalism's full restoration, the actual benefits of this in terms of the potential growth of Germany were squashed by the German ruling class's incapacity to actually recover from the legacy of World War II, and also their being in a series of treaties with both the US and the French in the form of both the EU and NATO that precluded the further growth of German imperialism again and reduced it to a supplementary role. And so these countries diminished and diminished over the years. The time for them to address these issues was the 90s. The early 2000s was probably the last time they could have engineered some kind of divorce with the United States. But even then, that's questionable whether they would have been strong enough to do that, because, again, too weak a position in terms of their actual economic situation led to, of course, too weak a political picture and too weak a set of personnel and institutions, and too easily dominated by American imperialism. So there's no chance of them escaping this now. They are as finished as the British are, and it might just take a little longer for the impact to be clear, but we're all on the same trajectory now. The ruling class of all of these places is on a nosedive, and they are going to attempt to make the rest of us pay for it. Which leads me to the questions from listeners from last night's broadcast that were brought up by last night's broadcast, when I was discussing my own interpretations of the nature of fascism and what does and doesn't constitute it. So there's been a question from listeners, which I'll now come to. And this is a question from Jay on the Telegram group, and I'll quote his question in full. I appreciated the update on fascism, but another question comes to mind. Can fascism fully develop in an imperialist country that can no longer expand its markets or its acquisition of capital? For instance, if the US arrives at the point where its ruling class is no longer able to expand globally for whatever reasons, how would fascism serve its purposes? Would it then just become a domestic phenomenon without the ability to strike militarily on the international scale to obtain or preserve its necessary imperial conquests? Would de-dollarization accelerate US fascism? Wouldn't a US fascism serve to cannibalize the US economy? And so this is an interesting question, because it brings up exactly the purposes of fascism and whether it's able to achieve that. And I'll draw upon the example of the Third Reich itself, the Nazis, to answer this question. Now, the Nazis, of course, began their territorial expansion first of all by, of course, remilitarizing the Rhineland and then expanding to Austria and then, of course, the what was then known as Czechoslovakia, all done by 1938, all done within 5 years. And there's, of course, real reasons that are related to the economic base as to why that had to happen. They had to conquer. It was the same problems that had been facing German capitalism all the way through its unified existence from 1870 onwards, which is it was a challenger in terms of the being the newcomer on the imperialist bloc, so to speak, and so therefore was facing a situation where the world had already been divided largely between the British and the French, and therefore needed to impose itself to violently secure its own division of the world. It secured certain colonies in Africa, places like Cameroon and what's now known as Tanzania and Namibia and Papua New Guinea over in Australasia and some other smaller territories as well, but nothing on the comparable scale to, of course, French and British imperialism. And so, of course, it had to try and impose itself and inside Europe, which led, of course, to the clash with the Tsarist Empire and their attempt to conquer Ukraine in World War One. Same thing happened in World War Two, ultimately. But the Nazi conquest of Austria and Czechoslovakia and ultimately Poland was powered also by the fact that they were running an unstable regime. It had successfully, in the immediate period after the Nazi coming to power in 1933, crushed the KPD, the German Communists, the SPD, and their associated trade union movements, and had suppressed labor struggles very violently. It didn't end labor struggles, though. There continued to be industrial disputes in the Third Reich all the way up to 1939, because even with the regime of state terror that the Nazis were running, class conflict didn't go away, nor could it be contained inside the fake syndicate organization that the Nazis were running called the German Labour Front. So there were still industrial disputes all the way up to the beginning of World War II. And there's some evidence to suggest that there was even some during World War II itself. There was industrial action inside occupied Netherlands and Belgium, for instance, in the early 1940s, which actually forced the Nazis to raise wages in those countries. Interesting detail. But I mention all of this because there is certain historical interpretations of the reason why the Nazis went all in on an invasion of Poland in 1939, and that was partly because, not wholly, but partly because the economic measures taken by the Hitler-led government up to that point through rearmament and hyper-exploitation of the working class and expansion of the arms industry had secured German economic growth. They had managed to put the economy back on the right track again. But that burst of growth was coming to a close. There was a renewed recession coming. And the pressure of that and the fact that Hitler had sidelined Hjalmar Schacht, the trusted technocrat of the German bourgeoisie, was part of the reason why the German economy was starting to show signs of instability. And that's part of the reason why the attack on Poland was carried out when it was. Again, I'm opposed to monocausal history, but the fact that the Nazi initial success on the economy was running out of juice by 1939, the fact that they hadn't managed to stamp out class struggle, because of course how could they, did push them towards greater aggressive imperialist actions. So Let's go back to the question posed by Jay, which is, well, what if a US fascism, for instance, couldn't actually expand its market share? What if, say, for instance, in 2026, we get an actual fascism coming to power inside the United States and it seeks to, at the very least, assert itself within what it regards as its hemisphere, but it is thwarted and unable to do that for whatever reason? Well, the first and immediate response would, I think, be an attempt to further increase the rate of exploitation of the domestic American working class by imposing even greater regimes of terror upon them. But then again, that's a risky prospect. If you're going to do that, then you can't just wipe out the domestic working class, even though some fascists might be tempted to. Again, the working class is needed to exploit. You could seek to bring in greater migrant labor if migrant labor still wanted to come to the United States. You could do that for the purposes of hyper-exploitation to an even greater degree than the repressed and crushed working class. And again, that would come with a whole series of political risks to a fascist regime. Most likely, though, what would happen is that if they were unable to impose this, then the door would be open to increased instability, attempted removal of the leadership, degeneration into just an open military coup against the civilian or semi-civilian fascist leaders, or a total implosion of the regime. Because one of the things about fascism is, because it's this based on this unstable class, the petty bourgeoisie, one of the things you notice about Hitler's rise in the late 20s, early 30s, was that they had to keep that base occupied. So they had to keep the Nazi Party in a state of constant activity. And this was mirrored in the constant activity of the Nazi government. New initiatives, new repressions, new conquests, new things for the base to get invested in. And they would have to do, any fascist regime would have to do that in order to keep its petty bourgeois base engaged and bought into the project. If the activity gets frustrated, if the conquest doesn't emerge, if the great and glorious imperial campaigns fall into dust, or they suffer from a severe military defeat, or if the working class actually organizes a fight back that is able to thwart the fascist plans, all of that immediately poses a huge risk to the stability of the regime. Because, again, if it can't present its base with a constant series of victories, then it has a huge problem and becomes very unstable. And, of course, then the ruling class, in this case, in this theoretical case that we're talking about, the American ruling class, then starts to look at, well, maybe there's another alternative. Maybe we need to pursue another line here, because the purpose for which we brought in the fascists hasn't been achieved. And if the fascists are brought in to rule under an emergency, they don't achieve what they said they were going to or unable to, then the whole regime will move into a crisis. And so you would likely be presented with an enormous crisis. Now, there is, of course, the other example to explore here, which is what happens with the Francoist regime, which comes to power as part of the rising tide of fascism in the 1930s, but is then unwilling or unable, bit of both really, to join World War II, even when the Nazis are on the up, though of course the Francoists did send the Blue Division to fight and die in huge numbers on the Eastern Front, but they didn't really get involved in World War II to any great extent, much to Hitler's annoyance. And after World War II, the fascist regime in Spain actually survives as a regime for another 30 years, up into the middle 1970s. That raises an interesting question about, well, what is the nature of that regime? Is it a fascist regime any longer? Because it doesn't and can't engage in aggressive acts of market acquisition overseas. Or is the more correct way to see it is that this regime headed by Francisco Franco comes to power in the 1930s, very much identifies itself with the fascist regimes of Italy and Germany, without whom, arguably, it couldn't have won the war. But is there an argument to say that, in actual fact, the Spanish regime actually belonged far more to the old Spanish tradition dating back over 100 years of pronunciamentos, or military coups, which is actually what the initial military rising in Spain was meant to be. It was meant to be just a quick military coup where the army, supported by the traditional reserve force of reaction in the Spanish state, the Guardia Civil, would rise up quickly, destroy working class opposition, and quickly impose a military regime in order to do the things that they wanted to do, which involved running things via a general or council of military men and reimposing the Spanish monarchy again. Now, because the working class resisted so heroically and so fiercely and for so long, the Spanish military had to readjust their tactics. They had to incorporate large amounts of the fascist organizations, such as the Falange and others, into their ranks. They had to assume the trappings of fascism in order to actually generate some more support from the Spanish petty bourgeoisie than they would otherwise have needed in just a quick and dirty military coup. And so it takes on the trappings of a fascist regime, but it comes to power through a military campaign in the form of the Spanish Civil War. And it comes to power, of course, in a very weak and fading imperialist power. And the Civil War in Spain, of course, you could argue, carries on for longer after 1939, because there's a long guerrilla war afterwards in the mountains, in the Pyrenees, in the Basque Country. And, of course, there's a titanic amount of state repression carried out by the Francoists. And so what happens at the end of World War II? Well, after some period of isolation, of course, the Francoists make certain changes to the state that make it more agreeable to the Americans, look to join NATO, and look to rebrand themselves slightly to take themselves away from being openly fascist, and make bargains with the United States. So after the late 40s, it becomes much more of a typical military regime with fascist trappings all over it. But what you see from the 1950s onwards is that though the regime remains ferociously repressive, and of course very much an anti-worker, anti-communist regime that throws people in prison, executes people, engages in all kind of brutalities, the fascist elements in it get pushed out. And you see this in the changing personnel in the Francoist regime in the 60s in particular, when they open up the country to foreign capital investment, when they replace the old-school sort of Mussolini-inspired phalangists in the state structure, or sideline them and replace them with these technocratic figures from like management schools and business schools. And so what they're doing is that it becomes still a military police dictatorship, but one in which increasing amounts of foreign capital are invested. The country becomes more open due to the package holiday boom, funnily enough, in the 1960s. So you have a military regime there that's very repressive, but the fascist elements of it have been pushed to one side. So you have, by the time of the Franco's death, not only have you got him acting as regent for King Juan Carlos, who will be restored, but you've essentially got a long preparation to move to some form of bourgeois democracy. Ultimately, this process was speeded up by Spanish working class action in the 1970s. But the point I'm making here is that, of course, when you get the Spanish regime to consider, that's an example of where a very weak and fading imperial power has a military coup that takes on fascist characteristics and then jettisons those and moves over to a different kind of dictatorship as things evolve later on. So that's an interesting example to bear in mind of when a regime emerges that is very much part of the rising of fascism in the 30s and then jettisons a lot of that, though it remains a repressive military police dictatorship in the 50s and 60s, and looks to move towards a sort of technocratic style of governance with the state repression slightly dialed down towards the end, though of course it remained a very repressive state. And that's one example of where a military police dictatorship actually ends up serving them better than this more wild and aggressive forms of fascism, because of course Spanish capitalism was far too weak to actually engage in aggressive imperial endeavors. And so that's as a consequence of that, the Spanish ruling class had to change the nature of that regime over time to make it something that was more acceptable to certainly US imperialism in order to attract investment, secure economic growth, and do so in a way that actually ended up compromising the Spanish nation and revealing the fact that Spanish capitalism is actually incredibly weak, and so for actually guiding it firmly into just being a satellite state of the American bloc. Something which, by the way, the Spanish Social Democrats under Felipe González in the late 70s and early 80s and all the way through to the 90s, very much kept up the same trajectory of policy that was begun under the mid to late Franco period, which is Spain increasingly being opened up for foreign capital investment, the diminishing and the fading of Spanish industry, and the turning of Spain into just a real estate and holiday destination, hollowing out Spanish cities, causing all the problems you see in places like Barcelona. Side issue, but important to point out the continuity there. But to return to our hypothetical example of the United States, given that if we see a fascist regime in the United States in the next few years after a consistent period of imperial decline, which we've already seen, an increase in domestic working class struggle, a fading of the ability of the state to enforce the will of the bourgeoisie through traditional means, and the increasing instability amongst the petty bourgeoisie, then at that point, of course, as I said yesterday, the American ruling class will look to the fascists to do a job for them. If the fascists can't do the job for them, then the American ruling class will look to some kind of other way of doing things, and that's why I drew upon the example of Spanish Francoism. So if they can't impose their will upon the other countries in the hemisphere, which is what they're trying to do currently in Haiti, if they can't do it through economic means, if they can't do it through military means, then you will see a gigantic crisis open up within the American ruling class, which if they bring in a fascist regime which can't even secure for them the hyper-exploitation of the Caribbean nations, for instance, or Mexico, or the return of countries like Venezuela and Colombia to being wholly dominated by the United States, which is a real risk that a more desperate US imperialism would try some kind of open military solution to their problems. If they can't do any of that, or they're thwarted, then a gigantic crisis will open up, because unlike the Spanish ruling class, who had gone through over 100 years of decline and therefore were more open to essentially just signing the country over to foreign investors, the American ruling class aren't there yet. They haven't had the over 100 years of decline the Spanish had. They hadn't had the multiple military humiliations, though they're starting to get them. And so it's going to be enormously difficult for them to accept this failure that would come. So the crisis that would be generated through a failure to secure new markets and new sources of exploitation would open up an enormous division and a crisis within the American ruling class, and would therefore open up more opportunities for the American proletariat and American communists to actually restart class struggle or elevate the class struggle to a new level. Because if you think of it this way, that if the American ruling class reverted to open fascism and the open fascism fails, that's a huge blow and a very important, real material blow, and also an important psychological blow for the American bourgeoisie that they would struggle to recover from. They would struggle to pivot to imposing a new military police dictatorship. And certainly, I don't think they'd do what the Spanish ruling class did, which was look to invite foreign capital to take over more and more of the American economy openly, to essentially bail them out of the mess they'd got themselves into. I can't see them doing that willingly, saying, hey, Xi Jinping, we made a giant mess of it. Would you care to bail us out by investing in America? I don't really think that's on the cards for now. Though, of course, the Chinese do have investments in America, but I'm talking, would the American ruling class, having gone through this period of humiliation and defeat that would be necessary before they got to the stage of turning to open fascism, would they then be inviting other nations openly into the heartland to take over even more and more American assets? Maybe not, but the huge opportunity would be provided to the American proletariat and American communists if they could successfully build a unified vanguard organization at that point of tremendous splits and chaos within the ruling class. American ruling class at the moment, for all that there's the frenzied bullshitting going on in the bourgeois political system, remains still fairly unified. I know there's a lot of talk in the US about potential civil war, which largely seems to come from people who spend too much time on Twitter. But you could see it if they get to the point where Bonapartism has failed, where fascism has failed. Certainly you will see more divisions as the crisis of US capitalism gets deeper, Which brings me back to the point I often end these shows on, which is it emphasizes the point that is most important, the most important crisis facing communists in most parts of the world, certainly the American bloc, which is the subjective factor being the leadership of the working class, the presence or absence of a vanguard party with the proper rooting in the working class, with the proper relationship with the masses, with the ability to actually formulate demands in the proper way, drawing from the experience of the masses and then taking that, turning it into a program and taking it back to the masses again. And the lack of that anywhere, other than in tiny agitational circles at the moment, is our central problem. Even to just glance over the comments that are made in the Telegram chat, for instance, over the October Revolution coming up, and many listeners there commenting that, well, we're politically isolated, we can't do a lot at the moment. Well, a lot of us feel that way. Even those of us who are members of organizations are reminded that what we're dealing with here is very fractured societies, very atomized condition of the working class, the dominance of the worst aspects of reformism all provide huge barriers, which makes a proper understanding of the situation, in my view, ever more vital to actually attain. We've seen the perils over the last few years of what happens when too many people get invested in false dawns, be that the Bernie Sanders false dawn, the Jeremy Corbyn false dawn, or the Donald Trump false dawn. All of these are dead ends to go down. And so therefore, perhaps the first task for us is a re-equipping of ourselves theoretically in a way that the sectarians don't really do. I'll give you an example of what they are doing at the moment, the sectarian organizations in Britain. I mean, I was walking around the city today, and every time you walk around one of the major university cities, which is what I was doing, you see the posters out from the various Trotskyite organizations, all of whom are now declaring that class struggle is back. That's what all the posters of the Socialist Workers' Party and others were showing when I was walking around today. And I was looking at these and laughing because they've been doing that for years. Every so often they'll declare that class struggle is back, and this is why it must lead to a renewed struggle to trans rights, which relates to the class struggle, the environmental destruction. The real class struggle is over the environment. The real class struggle is to secure a Green New Deal. Just wall-to-wall opportunism. Every, the meme, I support the current thing. Well, every current thing possible is, blaring out there from all the different so-called Marxist organizations in Britain. Not just the Trotskyists, but the pseudo-social democrats who disguise themselves as Marxists as well. And so there's very little that's ever been done in the British case. I will leave it up to American comrades and those from down under to say what has been done in their countries and their experiences. There's not really been a serious attempt to properly analyze where we are, because the interest of all these sectarian groups is just getting a new layer of students in to pay subs. And so therefore it's just the current thing, but with a bit of Marx attached to it. And that's why I'm developing the project that is Red Star Radio, Red Star Broadcasting, in the way that I am, because I'm thinking that by using this platform, I can play some part in actually developing these perspectives further. And so that's why I'm engaging these extended theoretical discussions, lectures, if you will, on the latter end of these daily bulletins. So I hope that's shed some more light on the question that was asked there. And if there's further comments on that, do be sure to leave them below. It's always good to make these daily bulletins as interactive as possible. So I'll be back with more of this tomorrow. Thank you for listening. You can find more of the programs that I've done on the Patreon page, which I'll link to in the description if you're listening to the free version of this. And if you want to support the work that I'm doing on the channel, do go over there and subscribe, because there's extra content on there, including the ongoing series, A Marxist History of World War II, and upcoming reading group stuff as well. So, again, thank you for listening, and I'll be back with you again tomorrow.